loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by Nicole Roussel and Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, thousands of Palestinians staged a sixth weekly protest today against Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, with some throwing stones and burning tires while Israeli soldiers fired live rounds. More than 170 people were wounded today. Since late March, 39 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,700 wounded by Israeli fire during the protests. Next, the United States warned China yesterday that there would be consequences for its growing militarization of disputed islands in the South China Sea, amid reports that it has deployed missiles to that area. The threat comes amid continued talks between the two countries to try to solve a major trade dispute and follows a formal complaint to Beijing over Chinese lasers being used to blind U.S. pilots in the Horn of Africa. Then, a delegation of members of Veterans for Peace has carried out massive civil disobedience demonstrations in front of the main gate at Camp Schwab, the U.S. military base on the island of Okinawa. The group is showing its resistance to the base by blocking truck traffic into and out of that gate. And then, some states are turning to a supply and demand-based system for toll roads, with skyrocketing costs for the consumer. The Wall Street Journal and others have been reporting on this change, asking the question, what is the best mechanism for reducing congestion? But is that the right question to ask about our infrastructure needs? And finally, we'll continue to look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Palestine. Thousands of Palestinians staged a sixth weekly protest today against Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, with some throwing stones and burning tires while Israeli soldiers fired live rounds. More than 170 people were wounded today. Since late March, 39 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,700 wounded by Israeli fire during the protests. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and the newly released book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Miko, I have to say that these Israeli military orders to shoot people in the legs reminds me very much of what happened in the First Intifada, where, and I think it was... Was it Sharon that made the order to break people's bones, or
it was Rabin? He was defense minister.
It was Rabin. That's right. It was Yitzhak Rabin. It seems like the policy is the same. It didn't work in the 1990s in that intifada. Why would it work today?
Well, whether it works or not, that depends on your perspective. I mean, the intifada was crushed, and the Palestinians were hurt, and that's really the only objective that they have. And, you know, as far as they're concerned today, like the current defense minister, Lieberman, said, there are no innocent civilians in Gaza. And the legal spokesman for the IDF said that issues of human rights don't apply right now in Gaza because this is a conflict, it's an armed conflict. And so different criteria apply, which is why what Israel is doing, according to Israeli law, is legal, what the soldiers are doing. Is legal, so they don't think they're doing anything wrong, and they can spin it whatever which way they want. The bottom line is they're shooting at innocent civilians whose only crime is that they want to go home.
Yeah, Miko, I mean, it seems like there's sort of this sort of perverse game of one-upsmanship between the different Israeli-Palestinians over who can support like the most brutal repressive policies, because, you know, that the Israeli Knesset is, you know, fragmented. You know, Netanyahu's party only has about a quarter of the vote. There's sort of, you know, each politician occupies their own lane. And it seems like the most sought after lane is like, you know, the extreme nationalist hardliner who's going to unleash, you know, the worst type of violence that they could realistically unleash against Palestinians, be they protesters, be they, you know, participants in the armed resistance, be they just random people. Talk a little bit about the internal Israeli domestic calculations. I mean, the defense minister now is Avigdor Lieberman, who's the head of, you know, one of the most extreme right-wing parties. You know, he's to the right of Netanyahu, believe it or not. Talk about that dynamic here.
Well, you're right. I mean, they're always racing to prove who can be more cruel, who can be more... who can exact more blood from the Palestinians, and that's what gets the votes. I mean, that's what Israeli society wants. That's what they like. That's who they seem to vote for. The more violence that is applied towards the Palestinians, the more unity you have, the more the more popular the army and the politicians seem to be. it's beyond explanation, really. And when you, and again, regardless of how they choose to spin it, the only crime the Palestinians in Gaza right now, what they're asking is to be allowed to go back to their land and their homes from which they've been denied for 7 decades. This is their crime. You know, they're pretending that this somehow they're trying to breach an international border. What they're trying to do is break through a prison wall. It's not an international border. It's a prison wall. But that's why they're being shot, because prisoners are not supposed to be given the right to break away from their prison.
The Israeli military, you know, using the same logic as the breaking bones policy, which was, you know, it's impossible for us to arrest every single protester who's participating in the Intifada. So instead of going through all that trouble, we'll just break their arm or break their leg so that, you know, they'll be unable to go to the protests, you know, the next day. When Israel is shooting a lot of these Palestinian protesters, they're using a special type of munition called a butterfly bullet that basically shreds itself while it's upon impact. So while it's inside of a person, you know, ripping apart bones, ripping apart arteries. And, you know, a lot of people are not just having to, you know, stay at home for months while their bones heal like they did during the first Intifada, but they actually are getting their limbs amputated as a consequence of this repression. I mean, the Israelis are also dropping tear gas through drones. I mean, comment on this use of sort of exceptional, you know, unconventional, I guess we could call it, types of munition, you know, types of arms to repress the Great March.
Well, there's been a report recently that after each assault on Gaza, within a month or so, arms sales increase. And Israel gets more and more, the client list of countries wanting to buy arms from Israel increases as well. And over the last 5 or 6 years, I think Israel's weapon sales has increased by 55%, which is larger than any other country, any other arms manufacturing country. And the reason that they are able to market so well and sell so well is because they can claim that these ammunitions and these weapon systems have been proofed and used in battle and proven themselves in battle. Of course, it's not a battle; it's shooting fish in a barrel. It's shooting against unarmed civilians who are defenseless, who are protesting for their right to go home and to their land and have every right to do so, regardless of the fact that it's a crime to shoot them, regardless of the fact that Israel is completely on the wrong on this issue. And the Palestinians are completely on the right. This is all about business. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about arms sales. And they know that this is going to increase their arms sales abilities and bring in more money to the state. And that's really what it's all about. And they can now prove that all these new and even more draconian ammunitions work. And the tear gas is changing. They're using different types of gases. They're using drones and what used to be called armed personnel carriers are now unmanned armed personnel carriers. And this is what it's all about. It's like a lab, really, for Israeli ammunition and for Israeli weapons.
You know, that's true about arms sales. I was just in Greece recently, and the Greeks have been touting very proudly their new relationship with the Israeli government, and the Greeks have become major arms purchasers, and not just arms, but things like tear gas and rubber bullets that the Greeks unfortunately used to put down demonstrations mostly in the capital. And the same thing is happening in Cyprus. The Cypriots are arming themselves with Israeli arms, and it spills over into the economic sphere too. You know, there's this new economic cooperation between Greece, Cyprus, and Israel that we've never seen before. And I think another part of this, a problem with this, is that we see what's happening in Palestine week after week after week, and there's really no international outrage, at least not where it would matter enough that it would cause the Israeli government to change its policy. So there's no incentive, there's no necessity to change this policy. They can keep on shooting Palestinians and nobody seems to care.
Yep, that's exactly the case. They keep on shooting and torturing and killing and maiming and gassing Palestinians and nobody seems to care. That's exactly the entire story. Nobody cares, which is why they're allowed to continue. And on the issue of arms sales, you've got the Greeks, the Cypriots, the Turks, you've got South Korea, Vietnam, India. I mean, everybody's buying weapons. Everybody's happy with this. Israel's relations, as Netanyahu himself said, with the Arab and Muslim world have never been better. Even countries like Malaysia, which won't recognize Israel, is buying is doing business with Israel. And this is, of course, you know, the Israelis are happy, these regimes are happy, and the Palestinians, once again, are being crushed and killed and maimed, and nobody cares. And I tell people now in my lectures, I just had one yesterday here at community college in New York, that you know, solidarity is no longer enough. You know, walking around with Free Palestine shirts and kufiyas is not going to do it. We need to act. We need to make sure that the McCollum bill gets through and gets support. We need to make sure that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions becomes more powerful and has an effects are being seen faster and stronger than ever before, or else this is never going to end. Palestinians are going to die. Palestine is going to disappear. And it's really a question of urgent care now and way beyond solidarity. And unless people act, unless all of us get up and act and do more, it's not going to change.
Yeah, Miko, the point about boycott, divestment, and sanctions was the last thing I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, we've been talking about all these horrible things that have been happening, but people can do something. BDS is one of them. Can you tell our audience in the last minute or so how people can find out more about BDS and how to get involved?
Well, go to bdsmovement.org. That's one way. If there are any Muslims that are listening, you know, Ramadan is coming up. Make sure that your store is not selling Israeli-made or Israeli-grown dates, and that you're not buying Israeli-grown dates. Make sure that the olive oil, the cosmetics, the lingerie, whatever it is that you buy, if it's made in Israel, should not be bought, should be taken off the shelf. You know, whether it's a local store, whether it's a supermarket, whether it's boycotting HP. I mean, these are things that have to be done, and we're the only people to do it as us. And also, we need to make sure that our elected officials know and understand that they should not support Israel, that they should not support foreign aid bill to Israel, and that when Israeli officials come and give lectures, whether it's churches or synagogues or college campuses, there should be protests. There should be a demand not to allow them, not to give them a stage.
Okay, that was the voice of Miko Peled. He joined us from Washington. Miko is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and the newly released book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
The United States warned China yesterday that there would be, quote, consequences, unquote, for its growing militarization of disputed islands in the South China Sea amid reports that it has deployed missiles to the area. The threat comes amid continued talks between the two countries to try to solve a major trade dispute and follows a formal complaint to Beijing yesterday over Chinese lasers being used to blind U.S. pilots in the Horn of Africa. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can read more of his writings at jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure.
Jack, it seems like the U.S.-China relationship has gotten very complicated very quickly. Now, that's probably just me being a layman talking, and I don't follow China as close as scholars do like you. But it just seems like all of a sudden the relationship with China has so many different facets, all of which have problems associated with them. Let's start by talking about this trade dispute. You've written extensively about U.S.-China trade. What can you tell us about this?
Well, you know, it's not really about U.S. trade deficit. You know, the $375 billion deficit on goods trade, which
as the president has alleged.
Yes. That's the cover issue. The real issue, I think, with the China-U.S. trade negotiations is technology transfer. I think the U.S. is getting very nervous that China is accelerating its technology development. Last year, China issued this 2025 vision document. And also last year, the U.S. Began to investigate the technology transfer. So all these trade initiatives against China were really developed last August when the Trade Department of the United States, USTR, was tasked to identify the technology transfer issue. And that's the big issue. Why? Because not just new products of the future, But technology trade and technology transfer has a lot to do with U.S. defense.
Yes.
I'm talking about artificial intelligence, 5G, wireless, cybersecurity. Right now, China is filing almost as many patents as the U.S. It's just the U.S. and China filing technology patents. The rest of the world's far behind. So the U.S. is worried. The technology transfer, both in the sense of requirements by China of U.S. companies doing business in China to transfer technology, and also China on the hunt to acquire companies in the U.S. that have technology. So the U.S. In a number of ways is on the defensive, and it's trying to slow down, stop, and whatever. Who's behind this in the U.S.? It's the defense establishment. And their advocates in the Trump trade team are Robert Lighthizer and Peter Navarro. These are the guys close to the Pentagon. And they're over there on the trade team. And you got Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary. He's over there as well. He's representing the big U.S. corporations and the bankers who want more access into China. And purchases of Chinese companies, majority purchases. And then you have Kudlow, who is on the team as well, Larry Kudlow, and he's representing Trump's strategy to whip up America first in the economic nationalist theme here before the November elections, and I believe also as a potential defense against Mueller when he fires Mueller, which is going to happen. So it's very complicated, domestic U.S. politics involved, U.S. defense strategy involved, and access to Chinese markets. I think what's going to happen is that they're going to reach some kind of an agreement where U.S. corporations, particularly bankers, will be allowed to have more access into China, and that's how they're going to try to reduce their trade deficit. There will be some token changes in tariffs and imports to the U.S. that Trump will then exaggerate and lie about to his political base. Look what I did with China. But the real nut that's going to be hard to crack is this technology transfer. I don't think the U.S. is going to achieve very much that way. But I think all Trump wants is something to exaggerate for his November elections and his political defense.
You know, Walter, I have to say, I agree with that. I think that a lot of this is personality based. It's Donald Trump and it's the people that Donald Trump has surrounded himself with. They have a viewpoint that's different than what the in-place policy has been over the years. And that's why it's a wild card. Before we turn to the South China Sea missile issue, I want to touch just for a minute about this this laser incident in the Horn of Africa. This happened in Djibouti yesterday. Djibouti is a very tiny country surrounded by Eritrea on the north and Ethiopia to the west, Somalia to the south. It's a bad neighborhood. But it's this small little island of stability, and there's a major U.S. military base there, Camp Le Monnier. There are U.S. Air Force personnel there, and there are lots and lots of drones. So yesterday, two pilots took off on regular routine maneuvers, and a laser was shown on them. It blinded them temporarily, and somehow this was traced back to Chinese personnel on the ground. Why would something like this happen?
Yeah, it's a really bizarre thing. I mean, when you think about, you know, lasers playing like a role in world politics. But yeah, I mean, it seems to have happened. I mean, of course, you know, both sides have an incentive to lie about what really went down. But yeah, I mean, Djibouti is very strategic. You know, it's close to the Bab el-Mandeb Straits, where, you know, the Red Sea and then subsequently all the traffic that goes through the Suez Canal comes through. And in addition to the U.S. having a base there, you know, China has a military presence, of course, and many other countries do as well. China's there. I mean, one of the reasons China, you know, needs that base in Djibouti is that it participates in a lot of the international anti-piracy missions.
That's right.
Off the coast of Somalia. So, I mean, I think, well, that's one thing to say. What China's doing with its base in Djibouti is fundamentally different than the U.S., which is like, you know, supporting the Saudi operation in Yemen, and sort of it's more of like a hegemonic thing, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of shows how, I think all of these different points of tension are not unrelated. You know, like the Trump administration likes to talk about like, okay, well, you know, there's the economic track with China, and then there's the stuff about North Korea and the stuff about, you know, the Middle East. And, you know, there's all these different silos. But really, I think when it comes to the U.S.-China confrontation, all things are connected. And so if there's, you know, disputes over trade, then maybe that'll flare up in the Horn of Africa.
Jack Rasmus, we're speaking with Jack Rasmus, who's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California. Jack, this dispute in the South China Sea, I know that you're not a military analyst, but it seems to me that this is a continuation of what we saw during the Obama administration with that administration's pivot toward Asia. We somehow have decided that the South China Sea is in our backyard, and we take great offense when the Chinese carry out maneuvers in the South China Sea or move military personnel or hardware. There are these missiles now in the South China Sea. Is this a threat to the United States? And how do you think the Trump administration is going to react?
Well, you know, the South, as you said, the South China Sea has always been considered U.S. territory. And historically, that's the area that the war with Japan began with. By that, I mean the U.S. blockaded Japan in early 1941 and stopped the flow of its oil from Indonesia to Japan. And this war machine, therefore, was going to come to a halt within a month. And, of course, that provoked Japan to attack the U.S. So, that whole area there is considered very strategic to the U.S. And now there's Duterte, the president of the Philippines, seems to be leaning more towards China because of that pressure in the South China Sea. So it's a thorn in the side of U.S. strategic planning. I don't think the U.S. can do much, if anything, about it at this point, except make a big stink and threat and posture. But China's going to go forward with this because it's within they consider their borders, they're going to continue the buildup. On the other hand, Trump wants China to help him deliver some deal with the Koreas, so he's just going to huff and puff. I don't think he's going to do anything about it. And then we have the trade issue on top of that. So, as you say, it gets very complicated, the military side and the trade side. But that's where technology comes in. And that's why technology trade and technology transfer is the linchpin for U.S. policy towards China in the coming years here. And that's why they're so concerned about that in these trade negotiations.
Yeah, it's all completely interconnected. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Please go ahead and check out more of his writings at jackrasmus.com. You won't regret it. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
A delegation of members of Veterans for Peace has carried out massive civil disobedience demonstrations in front of the main gate at Camp Schwab, the U.S. military base on the island of Okinawa. The group is showing its resistance to the base by blocking truck traffic into and out of the gate. We're joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus, and was one of the participants in the action in Okinawa. Bruce, welcome back. It's been a long time.
Thank you very much.
So, Bruce, walk our listeners through what this action was all about in Okinawa.
The Okinawan Peace Movement put out a call for 500 people every day. They just called it 500 for a week. So this would be last week. So they asked people to come from all over, and they asked specifically for Veterans for Peace to send some people. So four of us, one member that lives in Okinawa and three from the United States, went and joined the daily construction gate protests, blockages at Camp Schwab. Camp Schwab sits on pristine Ora Bay, where the United States is forcing the construction of an insane double double runway airfield on top of the bay, which will necessitate millions and millions of truckloads of landfill and huge rocks to be dumped actually into the bay in order to build this thing. It's an environmental disaster. The people have been protesting daily, if you can imagine, for 15 years. And so it's the third time that VFP has sent a delegation to sit and stand with the people of Okinawa.
In fact, the dumping of these rocks into the bay, Walter, results in sand and muck being churned up. And what it does is when it resettles, having been carried by the tide, it resettles on top of the coral reef. And it literally chokes the coral reef to death. So this is a potential environmental disaster, as Bruce Gagnon is telling us. It's absolutely true. And we've seen it in other places where the U.S. has done this kind of thing, like Bahrain in the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf. Exactly the same thing happened with the coral reef there.
Yeah, and I remember I was actually able to go to Japan several years ago to be part of similar anti-war demonstrations, although not in Okinawa. It was in Iwakuni, Japan. And in addition to the environmental destruction, you know, in terms of like the physical geography, there was also, you know, many animal species that were going extinct as a consequence. People were being displaced from their houses. Houses were being knocked down to build barracks. Bruce, in Okinawa, you know, in addition to the environmental destruction, what are the other grievances that people have with the U.S. military presence there? I mean, usually there's a sharp uptick in crime, right, wherever the U.S. military lays down, you know, a permanent presence.
That's right. Actually, one day during the week while we were there was a anniversary, if we could use that word, of the murder of an Okinawan woman by a U.S. contractor, military contractor, former Marine, who killed her. And these kind of things happen routinely, rapes, murders. Just the last time I was in Korea, a drunken U.S. Marine crashed his military vehicle into an old mini truck driven by an old man and killed him outright. And then there are all these kind of crashes that are happening with U.S. Osprey aircraft and other aircraft. And again, when I was there last time, a window fell out of a U.S. helicopter and landed right in the middle of a daycare center playground where children were playing. Luckily, no one was hurt. But the Okinawan people have really had it because the United States has occupied Okinawa since 1945, when the Battle of Okinawa killed one quarter of all the civilians on the island. U.S. took control from Japan and has been there ever since. And I've been to a couple museums and, much to my surprise, saw that they've been protesting routinely since 1952. You'd never know that back here in the United States watching the mainstream media.
Bruce, tell us what the reaction was to your presence and to the presence of the other 500 demonstrators there. I've seen your website, which I would encourage our listeners to go to. It's veteransforpeace.org. Tell us how you were welcomed by the people of Okinawa, but then also by the authorities there.
Well, the people are very grateful to have veterans there because there's so many GIs on that island, and they really relish the opportunity to have American peace people, but especially American former GIs, to be there wearing the Veterans for Peace shirts, being seen by U.S. military personnel. And in fact, every time a Marine truck would pass in front of the gate, I would jump up and run out and block it in the street with my shirt on, just because I wanted them, and my baseball hat, I wanted them to see that there were Americans there, and their eyes got very wide. But they bring in police from the mainland of Japan. They don't use Okinawan police very much, and so they bring in hordes and hordes of police from the mainland, who many of whom are trained in martial arts, and they're very rough with the people. They grab you. There's so many people there that they can't arrest everybody. They just couldn't humanly process all that. So what they do is they create essentially jails right on the street between the fence of the base and the curb, where they park like five police buses, close off either end, and they, as they pull you away and drag you or carry you away very brutally from the construction gate where people are sitting and blocking, they then throw you in this outdoor jail cell for a couple hours until everyone is cleared. The trucks, the dump trucks, go in with their huge rock and gravel supplies, and then the other trucks come out, the empty trucks come out, and then they open it back up and let the people out of these little jail cells. So it just goes on like that day in and day out. And the other interesting thing, and this is a really sad story, virtually all the mayors on the island, particularly from the two big cities, Nago City and Naha City, were opposed to the base construction project in this case, and also the governor. And what the United States and Japan are now doing is picking off one after the other of these mayors. They've got all but one now that they've thrown out of power by bringing in massive amount of monies to support right-wing candidates, using the media, the mainstream media, to demonize the opposition. And so they're next to going after the governor, and they're working up a candidate, a very rich corporate guy who's been throwing events for younger people, 250,000 at the last event. He brings in musicians, comedians, actors from the mainland Japan, and for free all these young people go and attend. And so they're really trying to depoliticize the next generation. The older generation remembers the Battle of Okinawa in 1945. Many of them lived through it as young people, and the memories are very strong. So they're really trying to depoliticize the next generation.
What's the attitude of the central government, the government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe? You know, of course, the people, as you were describing, of Okinawa itself are opposed to the construction of the base. But what about the government in Tokyo?
The government in Tokyo is behind this the whole way, carrying water for the United States. Abe was the grandson of what the Chinese called a Class A war criminal. He was on Tojo's imperialist cabinet during World War II. And so Abe is really a bad actor, and he's totally in the bag in the United States. When Obama was president, his ambassador to Japan was Caroline Kennedy, JFK's daughter. And when she came to Okinawa, the people asked for a meeting with her, and she refused to meet with the people of Okinawa. So this is a bipartisan program that's been going on through the Obama administration and even before.
Well, this is something, as you say, Bruce, that's gone on for decades. It's probably going to continue to go on until enough of us rise up, I suppose, and force change and force a stop to it. We'll end it there. We were joined from Maine by Bruce Gagnon. He is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus, and he was one of the participants in the action in Okinawa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for Brian Becker.
Some states are turning to a supply and demand-based system for toll roads, with skyrocketing costs for the consumer. The Wall Street Journal and others have been reporting on this change, asking the question, what is the best mechanism for reducing congestion? But is that the right question to ask about our infrastructure needs? We're joined from Carrboro, North Carolina, by Katie Lang, a local transit advocate and an organizer. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Katie, we have a local road here in the Washington, D.C. Suburbs, Northern Virginia, Interstate 66. And there's a stretch now that is a toll road. It goes from the Capitol Beltway to downtown Washington, and it's about 7 miles. Well, it's not unusual during the morning rush hour to see tolls of $40, $50, even $60 to travel that 7 miles. Not a rhetorical question here. How is that fair to consumers? And does it really address the issue of traffic congestion when it seems to me that the high tolls just push cars onto other roads?
That's a great question, John. And I've been following that toll road, I-66, and the debate around the tolls for a while. So, it's a sticky question. I think what you're getting at with missing the bigger question is a good point. We are seeing a rise in tolling. And when tolling is done well, it can have an impact on reducing congestion. It can even have an impact on transportation funding when the tolls are allocated toward paying for things like improved bus service. And my understanding is that this is what is being done for I-66, although we have yet to see really those increases in improvement in transit. There is also evidence that tolling does encourage alternative transportation. But usually implementing a toll lane requires widening the road and adding a lane to existing highways. That just creates this induced demand. Drivers see that supply, it increases the demand. And as the Wall Street Journal reported it, so many of these expressed or tolled lanes are still congested.
Absolutely correct. I can tell you too that this debate has been going on in Northern Virginia for something like 30 years. Local residents, of which I am one, full disclosure, have opposed widening the road for exactly the reasons that you cite. The money, I think, again, my own personal opinion, the money is better spent on mass transit, on bus service, on metro, frankly, on maintenance.
Yeah. So, Katie, I think this is the bigger concern here, or at least my bigger concern. You know, the Wall Street Journal and many other, this is not just the Journal, many other publications are focusing on states that are turning to the free market to ostensibly improve traffic on the roads. But this isn't the bigger question. The bigger question is, you know, what should we be spending infrastructure money on? Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah. In the transit advocate space, that really is our question. Why do we have so much vehicular traffic, and what does our transportation system really need to look like, or what should it look like to move the most people? So you get hopefully more people talking about moving persons as opposed to moving vehicles. We do not do a good job in this country of providing transit, pedestrian, or bicyclist infrastructure. The federal money is about split 80-20 on roads and transit. So kind of no wonder people drive.
Wow.
We make it easy. That's what we fund. And I'm seeing right now more of a movement toward what those in the transportation space call complete streets. And those are streets that accommodate the needs of all people who might be reasonably expected to use it. And that's regardless of their ability, their travel mode, or their risk tolerance.
Katie, Arlington, Virginia prides itself on being what's called a gold city for walkers and bicycle riders. It always ranks at or near the top as one of the best cities in the country for joggers as well. Frankly, I'm very happy to pay my taxes in Arlington, Virginia, because I know it's well spent and it goes to things like mass transit, for example. Do you see that anywhere else in the country? Are there other cities that are examples for the rest of the country to follow?
Certainly. So you definitely see it in some of the larger cities. San Francisco and New York City have done amazingly well at reducing traffic fatalities and being more pleasant places to take transit, walk, and bike. And that's largely by bringing different city departments together and changing the way that their streets look. So it's really an infrastructure question. But there are some mid-size or smaller cities that are doing a great job. Indianapolis comes to mind. They just last year did a complete bus system redesign, put in bus rapid transit, and they're having great success, increased mode share there.
What is bus rapid transit again? Would you just explain that for the audience?
Sure. A great question. So bus rapid transit is a bus that really acts more like a train. There's usually level boarding so that folks on wheels, wheelchairs, or strollers can board easily. The biggest criteria is that it really has to have a dedicated lane. So the bus is not pulling in and out of mixed traffic, and customers are more easily and safely able to access that bus. And then there's other cities that are doing not necessarily whole transit system redesigns, but smaller improvements. The Walk Friendlies community program, like you mentioned, John, Arlington is always a contender there. The League of American Bicyclists also does a bike-friendly communities list every year. And there are some smaller cities on there, Plano, Texas, Auburn, Alabama, even Carrboro, North Carolina are make that list. And that's largely because they're able to put in some small infrastructure improvements like bike lanes or sidewalk connectivity.
Yeah, not every city has to be like Los Angeles, where it's, you know, spread out and it's practically the size of Rhode Island. You can do this and make it work and make it cost effective and make it efficient and make it cheap enough so that working people or the poor can get from point A to point B and not have to scrimp and save and buy a car and then just further clog the roads.
And we're actually seeing, with millennials kind of not wanting to move back to the suburbs, we're seeing such a massive increase in the number of people who are moving to cities. So in my mind, seems like transit and pedestrian advocacy is having an even more important time for those resources to be there. Katie, could you tell us a little bit more about the benefits of improving transit and improving community access to basic needs and services? Is that helpful for communities?
It absolutely is. So that term I mentioned before, complete streets, when you think of a complete street, you can basically think of a street that anybody can use and that is safe and equitable and complete for those people. And those streets have benefits like reducing injury risk. We know that people who ride transit, it's very safe to ride transit, much more so than driving in a car. The travel distances are reduced. Travel times are reduced, so you're spending less time in a vehicle when you're taking transit or walking or biking to your destination. And then here we start to bleed in a little bit and talk about land use, because a complete street that is out in the middle of nowhere is obviously not doing anybody any good. You need to integrate these transportation networks so that you do have that increased access to economic opportunity, whether you walk, bike, or take transit. But some of those other benefits are that people don't have to pay for fuel. They don't have to pay for parking. Exercise is kind of built in, getting out, breathing the fresh air. And there are other public benefits too. There's congestion reduction when more people are taking transit or walking. And there's more efficient land uses. When you don't need to build a giant parking deck downtown, you could build a daycare or affordable housing. So there's a lot of interconnected land use and transportation considerations that mean that our communities can be even better when we encourage people to walk, bike, or take transit.
And, you know, it's that really excellent land use planning that makes cities like Arlington, Virginia, Bethesda, Maryland, elsewhere around the D.C. area, Loudoun County, Virginia, competitive when they're trying to land a business like the new Amazon headquarters, for example. Not everybody wants to get in a car and get on a highway and drive to work and pay a $40 toll and sit in bumper to bumper traffic. When you have the availability of buses, you have the availability of a sophisticated, clean, and efficient subway system. And, if Arlington County has its way, even a gondola can connecting it with Georgetown.
That's pretty cool.
in Washington, D.C.
The gondola is like the silver bullet of transportation problems.
And these complete streets, Katie, these are like the Washington Monument downtown, like the mall where you can walk as a pedestrian, but there's also bike paths. There's also paths for cars. Is it kind of like that where everyone can access this road?
It can be like that, but it could be as simple as just making sure that there's sidewalk connectivity.
So the sidewalks don't just run out in the middle of the street and all of a sudden you're kind of just stuck after walking.
Exactly.
You know, it's funny, just as an aside, this is neither here nor there, but I live in Arlington, Virginia, as I said a few minutes ago, and I live in a semi-urban part of Arlington. It's great. It's, you know, big buildings and restaurants and clubs and what have you. But fully half of the blocks in our neighborhood don't have sidewalks. And this is a result of a very long debate between neighbors where some are afraid that sidewalks will encourage people to walk up to their windows and look in, which sounds preposterous.
It doesn't make any sense.
But is actually like a big deal in Arlington. At the same time, it allows for wider roads because there are no sidewalks. Katie, we've got less than a minute left. Tell us how people can get involved in this issue and tell us even where they can find more information.
Yeah, so people who are more interested in complete streets can look at the National Complete Streets Coalition. They have a catalog of everywhere in the country that's implementing complete streets and a lot of great resources besides. And then I would encourage people to look in their local community. Almost everywhere there are transit advocacy groups. Atlanta has the MARTA Army. Wake Up Wake County is an organization here in North Carolina that's doing a lot for transit. League of American Bicyclists, America Walks. There's a lot of great advocacy groups out there. People really care about this stuff, like you said, John. And we have to fight tooth and nail to make our streets safer. Our streets were built incomplete. So we really need people out there on the streets making them more accessible and more people friendly.
We sure do. Thank you very much. We're out of time. We were joined from Carrboro, North Carolina by Katie Lang. Katie's a local transit advocate and an organizer. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Nicole Roussel, sitting in for Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back.
Hi, John. Hi, Nicole.
Steve,
hi.
These are some really great headlines this week. I mean, I enjoy this segment every week, but this is a special week. Our listeners should know, too, that we share these stories just amongst ourselves before we do this segment over the course of the week, so we get a chance to really appreciate them. So let's start at the very beginning and tell us the first article that you chose.
Well, this headline is not worst or misleading. It's actually quite leading. The headline reads, "Clinton, being a capitalist probably hurt me with Democratic voters," which is funny, but... True.
Let me read
her quote, and then I'll comment on it. Her quote in this to The Hill. She says, "It's hard to know, but I mean, if you're in the Iowa caucuses and 41% of Democrats are socialists or self-described socialists, and I'm asked, are you a capitalist? And I say, yes, but with appropriate regulation and appropriate accountability, you know, that probably gets lost in the, oh my gosh, she's a capitalist." And earlier in another interview, she said, "The reputation of capitalism is pretty much in tatters for young people."
Oh my gosh.
So,
I mean, she's right.
On the one hand, it's very refreshing that she's not blaming Comey or the Russians or Jill Stein for her loss. She's actually talking about her actual policies. But if you read the quote carefully, she's not blaming herself, mind you.
Oh, no.
She's blaming these dumb socialist Democrats who didn't understand that she's not really a capitalist. You know, she's a capitalist for, you know, who thinks that regulation would make capitalism,
more palatable,
acceptable.
I mean, and it also, if you read more closely, you also see that this is very clearly hit straight at young people. So this is like, well, millennials don't listen and they didn't hear me say regulation. And it's not that they're actually, you know, interested in planning for the people rather than planning for profit. They don't listen. That's what it was.
Yes, it's the young people's fault.
Dumb millennials.
The other thing I like about this quote is her distinction between socialists and self-described socialists. I was wondering if there was a test that you have to take to be an actual socialist.
That's right. That's a really good point.
Self-described socialist.
They think they're socialists, but they don't really know.
You know, we have to remember, too, that Hillary Clinton was a Republican and actually worked on the Republican side on the Watergate Committee in the 1970s. And, you know, I can't help but to think that deep down in her heart, there's still a little bit of Republican in there.
There's at least a little bit. Yeah, I think that's probably right.
And the second headline that you chose, Steve, is great, too. It comes from a UK paper. It's a tabloid paper, but tabloids are fun, too.
They have headlines, too.
Yep. Go right ahead.
You know, we've picked on Elon Musk several times on this show.
Yes, we have.
So this week it's time for another billionaire, which is Amazon's Jeff Bezos. And this headline, there were a number of serious headlines in other papers about this story, but this one comes, to me, it came straight out of Nicole's mouth. Sounds just like Nicole, so I would like her to read it.
"I've got way too much cash, thanks Jeff Bezos. Pay more tax? Pay staff more? Nah, let's just go into space."
Which is essentially what he said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of improving healthcare or paying his people more, and he's one of the largest employers in the world, he decided to create an Amazon space program.
Quote, "The only way that I can see to deploy this much financial resource is by converting my Amazon winnings into space travel. That's basically it." That's his quote. Like, you could have finished that sentence with anything else and it would have made more sense.
And it goes on to say that 11.8% of Amazon workers are on food stamps.
But so space travel is very important. So let's make sure to do that.
And actually, his space program, unlike Elon Musk, who's also in the space business and is actually delivering supplies to the space station, Bezos's program is for space travel. So it's just a way to provide, in the future anyway, luxury tourist destinations for other billionaires.
Right,
we're
not talking about medical research here.
No,
scientific research or anything like that. And actually, this is a very serious story because this whole thing, I mean, it just points to the whole idea of that millionaires and corporations are not taxed enough, and so they have they end up with too much money they don't know what to do with. And the next story is a very serious development to that, which is that Seattle is trying to deal with their housing problem, which is caused by prices, housing prices going up due to Amazon, just like where I am, housing prices going up due to Apple and Facebook and so on. So Seattle's trying to put through a tax plan, which would end up costing Amazon $20 or $30 million a year. And Amazon is fighting Amazon, who made $5.6 billion in profits last year, is fighting tooth and nail in politically against this tax in Seattle, which was going to cost them $20 or $30 million. I mean, it's an outrage, is what it is. Not funny at all.
But see how well regulated this is. I mean, this is what Clinton would be supportive of, and these millennials, you know, they just don't understand that this kind of regulation, you know, is totally fine, and that Amazon shouldn't have to pay these taxes.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a related Amazon issue, too. I'll let you go right into it. This is from the L.A. Times.
This is from the L.A. Times. And to me, it sounded just like it was a PR release from Amazon. The headline reads, "The unspoken factor in Amazon's search for a new home, Jeff Bezos's support for gay rights." So apparently Jeff Bezos in the past had made a big donation to help defeat some anti-LGBTQ referendum in Seattle. And so that's great. I'm happy that he's a supporter of LGBTQ rights. But the interesting, at the very end of the article, after this whole article about how Amazon is looking for a gay friendly town to set up their new headquarters, is the following sentence: "It is not known how much a region's stance on gay rights ultimately will factor into its decision."
Oh, God.
And given the previous story, which is Amazon isn't even willing to pay $20 million a year to help provide housing in Seattle, I'm going to say very little. Yeah, I'm going to say this whole gay rights, they're looking for a gay-friendly thing, that's like the last thing on their agenda. And it's how much tax benefits they're going to get from some city which is willing to give them tax breaks and so on, which is going to be the deciding factor.
That's exactly what's going to be the deciding factor. It's all about the money. I don't care what Bezos says. I don't care what the Amazon press releases say. It's all about the tax breaks and the money. That's what it comes down to.
You have to read the next one.
The next one is my favorite one of the week. I've tweeted it. I've Facebooked it. I actually followed this story from the very beginning because it was so disgusting that it was like watching a train wreck. I couldn't tear myself away from it. So what we have here is a high school in New Jersey where each day human excrement is found on the jogging track or the school grounds. And so, you know, people were speculating it was some homeless person or a prankster or something, but it kept happening. And so the police set up cameras. And they caught the guy. And who was it?
Who was it?
I mean, you can't write this in a comedy.
Who was it?
It was the superintendent of the school district taking a dump every day in public on the school grounds. He's been arrested and charged with several different charges, exposing himself and littering. They charged him with littering, actually, which made me laugh out loud.
Public
but
littering.
Go ahead with the headline, Steve.
Yeah, I like the headline. New Jersey mystery pooper scandal. We have so many unanswered questions. The first question was, who is this pooping Tom?
It's someone with a PhD.
Yeah, the article went on to say that he has a PhD in educational administration and a master's degree from Rutgers, which is totally irrelevant to what he was doing.
That's right. He didn't need a degree to poop in public, I guess. He was good at that on his own.
Yeah. Well, listen, I don't want to gross out our listeners, so we're going to move on to the next one, which I also like very much. This is from CNN Money. And as funny as it was, this was also offensive. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, this is a CEO in a Walmart subsidiary in England, and he was doing an interview on one of the shows. But before they started the show, the mic was hot, and here's the headline: CEO caught singing "We're in the Money" as Walmart deal lifts shares. So his personal shares went up $500,000, and there he was on the mic, rejoicing in this fact, singing "We're in the Money." I suspect his employees are no more well paid than Amazon's employees, but he's in the money because he's the CEO and he's got the shares. So,
I mean, we can all relate. There's a hot mic around. Yeah. Your fortune all of a sudden goes up $500,000. Like, what do you know? You got to sing, right? It happens every day.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really does. We've got a whole bunch of other headlines, but we have less than a minute left, so I want to jump to one about the border wall. Steve, tell us about that.
Okay, well, this bothered me because the headline in Time read, Donald Trump's border wall is already a reality in this Texas town, the town being Brownsville. Except the problem with that headline is it's not Donald Trump's wall, because this wall that was built in Brownsville was authorized in 2006, and it had the votes of Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer and Dianne Feinstein, Joe Biden and Barack Obama, and was built while Barack Obama was president. But, you know, so this whole idea that it's Donald Trump's border wall is not complete nonsense.
Ridiculous.
It's a full bipartisan Democratic Republican border wall, which already exists in many places. And it's true. Trump is trying
working together to waste
this
money.
Is the,
trying to expand it.
The story of Washington. We've got to end it there. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. You can now follow us on Twitter, at Loud Clear Radio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.
Oh,